Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Insight. Today we have a very special guest joining the program today. His name is Al Suarez. He's been a Facebook friend of mine for a couple of years now, and I've spoken to him by phone and over the internet. Haven't personally met him, but I really am enjoying this great opportunity to be able to speak with Al in regards to a recently published book that that you can now find through Amazon, and the name of that book, and what we will be discussing is Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. And once again, the name of that book is Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. And Al, I would like to welcome you to the Socialist Insight today. Thanks for joining the program.
Thanks for having me, comrade.
Al, we have a lot of things that we can discuss today, and for the first part of our program, we're going to be talking a little bit about your book. You were very involved in the Occupy movement. You were out there in the streets. You worked with many comrades in regards to the organization of Occupy there in Florida, throughout the country. And now, after much of your involvement, What you did is you sat down and you actually put together a book, Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. Al, what inspired you after all of your involvement in Occupy, what inspired you to write your first book?
Well, I've always enjoyed writing. And just to be clear, the title of the book is Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. Yeah, and there really is a question mark on the movement today, and I'm sure we're going to get into that. But I've always enjoyed writing, and I found the experience, a learning experience in my life and a very inspiring experience at the same time. I was subsequently arrested a couple times in movement and doing acts of civil disobedience, and several times got close to getting arrested in New York and Boston and these other cities up and down the East Coast that I had the opportunity to go to. So I always wanted to take part in a movement like this, 24/7 protests, living on camps in the cold, and then ending up in Florida. And, so it was an experience that, is part of our modern history that needs to be looked at. There's a lot of aspects of the movement that people don't talk about that's in my book. So it's a unique opportunity for people to go and to see that part of our nation's history, which is part of a worldwide movement as well. You have the Indignados in Spain that started up at the beginning of 2011. The economic crisis in Europe, and then you had the Arab Spring. So all these events eventually inspired the Occupy Wall Street movement, which pretty quickly spread throughout the nation and camps in all these major cities. And you have people today, students, that still haven't heard of Occupy Wall Street. It's incredible. Didn't really portray the movement that well, or the lack of coverage in general, to the point where just a couple years later, people never even heard of it. I have book shows. I ask people, have they heard of Occupy? And they haven't. So this book's really the show from the inside what went down,
Who is this that you say hadn't heard of Occupy? I mean, it was everywhere. It was on the internet. It was on television. I mean, everyone was talking about it in the streets. If they weren't in the streets, who say they hadn't heard about it?
Well, there's a lot of people. You'd be surprised, even in different generations of people, not just young people. People that were too busy with their job, to really turn on the TV or really understand the context of the movement that was going down.
Right. Al, it is very incredible how quickly Occupy, it spread through the country and the nation like fire. I mean, it seemed like the nation, the left, was ready for that movement. What was there in the country at that time that inspired people just to go and hit the streets and just, say that they had enough? What was it?
Well, the economic crisis in the United States started in 2008. So the movement
started
in 2011. So over the course of those 3 years, a lot went down worldwide.
Right.
That really inspired the Occupy movement to start in the United States in New York. And the October 2011 movement in Washington, D.C. coincided with the Occupy Wall Street movement. And together, they spread throughout the nation. You know, and I had rats for a long time, and they were at the forefront of helping to organize this movement. And eventually, you had these, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into this at some point, the new wave anarchists that got into the movement, and they...
Right.
I have nothing against anarchism, but I'm talking about the new wave one, you know. They're really
right.
against the whole organizational structure, because if you're part of so-called hierarchy, then
oh,
you're
yeah.
an enemy.
They were very much against it.
Right. So that caused a lot of division as well, let alone, you know, the infiltration and the government and all these other things. But within the movement itself, there was a lot of ideological differences as well. The question of homelessness and how to go about, you know, solving these social problems, because it was very much a social movement. It wasn't just political
right.
or economic.
Al, I want to ask you something. Do you think with many of the broken promises that we had from Barack Obama, he ran for election in 2008, and in 2009, Obama had 2009, 2010, and 2011, as you mentioned, right after the economic crisis, and all of a sudden people realized that we elected this guy with all these hopes, and all of a sudden the nation was disappointed. I mean, Wall Street
right.
was receiving all the blessings, and the working people
right.
were only being cursed. And it seemed like people were, like, at that point where they're saying, what Obama promised is not working. And all of a sudden, it seemed like people at that point, after 3 years of Obama's failed promises, it
mm-hmm.
seemed like the left was just ready to hit the streets. It's like they were pissed off. You think
well,
that had
Obama
something to do with it?
What? And you know very well, you ran for President of the Socialist Party USA. Obama accomplished what Bush couldn't. Bush wanted to do the bailout.
Exactly.
He wanted the very people that got us in this mess, to use our tax dollars so they could buy private jets and raise their salaries of the CEOs, and that's exactly what they ended up doing. There was no trickle down. So it went to the top 1% who controlled the economy with our tax dollars. That's exactly what Obama did. So to say that Obama's progressive is ridiculous. We need to form a left opposition. We need to form a united front. The third parties need to unite. That's the only way to combat the so-called two-party system. And as Chomsky calls them, they're the same party. They're both the pro-business party. And the businesses and the corporations over the people, man. That's what it is.
Al, what I'd like for you to do is I'd like for you to share some of the contents there in your books. Not the whole book, because obviously we want people to order this, Ken. As I mentioned, we have Al Suarez. He's joining our program today. And his book is Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. But Al, just in brevity, could you share some of the contents of what your book is about?
Sure. I give you the table of contents, and there's 16 chapters, including many essays of mine written at that time, and pictures as well. So I'll read out to you the table of contents real quick. So there's the intro, chapter 1, tragedy. Chapter 2, Vermont. Chapter 3, back to my hometown. Chapter 4, trip to the Capitol and back. Chapter 5, the last stand. Chapter 6, New Year's in New York with Occupy. Chapter 7, in D.C. for Ashley. Chapter 8, the deaths of Chief and Brian Arredondo. Chapter 9, Level 3 Sex Offenders Proposal. Chapter 10, Allegations. Chapter 11, Providence. Chapter 12, Tampa. Chapter 13, Safe Haven in New Haven. Chapter 14, New Haven Civil War. Chapter 15, in NY for a 6th anniversary of Occupy, and Chapter 16, Return to Tampa, with the conclusion.
Well, there's two areas I want you to cover for me. One thing is I have traveled back and forth to New York for many things with the Socialist Party and for political activism, and also I worked in Florida with the Long Island Citizens Campaign back in the 80s. But I want you to share two things. I lived in Tampa. I worked with the Florida Consumer Action Network there also in the 80s. But what was your trip like there to New York? Because we know that that's really where the Occupy movement really started, was launched here in this country. What was your trip like there? And also, what was things like there in Tampa?
Well, unfortunately, I didn't arrive to Zuccotti Park in New York City until the camp was already shut down, but I did meet a lot of people that were the people that helped start the movement. The first time I was there was New Year's, 2011, and about a month before the camp was completely shut down. Right around the time I started to occupy Boston, which is my hometown. But, yeah, they, you know, we went to New Year's. It's funny because we used to have money, you know what I mean? We used to have, you know, independent contributors that made it so we could buy the Megabus tickets. You know, everybody knows from the Northeast that Megabus tickets are very cheap.
Right.
You don't need an ID or anything to take them. So we used to take the Megabus down to New York, D.C., or wherever we were going. And, yes, sometimes the unions helped out, sometimes individuals helped out. But we had money in the beginning to travel to these places. People wonder, like, how can poor people and homeless people that are activists travel to all these cities? Well, contributions. So I took the bus to New York for New Year's with a group of occupiers, and it was an incredible experience. You know, and I don't want to get into too many details. You got to see the book. But, you know, I put this piece of the book out there on Facebook while I was in the process of writing it. It took about a year to write. But, yeah, I got there, and, you know, the camp was gone, but the spirit of revolution was still there. And
right.
You can guess what my New Year's resolution was, revolution.
Uh-huh.
So nonviolent
right.
revolution was on our minds and in our hearts at that point in the movement. We were still very much united and very much
right.
defiant against the state and the brutality, the extreme brutality that I witnessed from the NYPD. I mean, beating little girls into seizures. I mean, this is stuff that I personally witnessed, okay? And we tried to de-arrest. We tried to stop it, you know. We were able to take over parts of the park. We were able to make Mount Liberty for New Year's, you know, with the barricades, the police barricades that we built up, you know.
Right.
So it's been enough time I could really get into it, you know, legally, because I was arrested a couple of times. I had to take care of that in court as well. But, you know, comrades were brutally beaten, just as they were in the streets of Cairo during Mubarak's
right.
time. You know, Americans love to know what's going on in Egypt and other countries. But in their own country,
right.
a lot of times they have no clue of the same brutality that,
right,
that Washington is imposing upon us.
Right. And these are people, Al, what we're talking about is brutality, people exercising their constitutional rights.
Yeah.
I mean, and what took place, I mean, here what I see that took place, Al, these were people that first the Obama administration, they embraced this, or at least they made it appear like they were embracing the Occupy movement. And then after that, they let all of the dogs out, and you saw cops everywhere. So basically what it was, you had the Obama administration, it was suppressing the Occupy movement across the country, and that's what I saw there in New York. And the same thing, you saw that there in Tampa also, correct?
I mean, Tampa, by the time I got to Tampa, activism was pretty much dead, okay? They were actually never very active in Tampa in the first place. But, you know, I tried to inspire the comrades as best I could down here to do actions. But, you know, Florida's a penal colony. You know, we're going to get into that. But it's just, you know, most of the kids down here, they're worried about the next party. They don't care about Marcelle Alexander or have ever heard of her. But
what did you think,
you know,
of, what did you think
care,
of
you know, they're
what did you think of Oakland?
They do, and they get thrown right into the jail system. You know, they don't even care over here. But
what about Oakland? I mean, Oakland, they were.
Oh,
I mean,
they're much
they
more
were
radical. I mean, that's where the
they were really
started.
Radical.
That's your neck of the woods. You know.
Oh yeah, they were real radical, and also in California, you saw there in San Francisco, and even Los Angeles, San Diego, they were very radical in both those parts. But we can see that the Occupy movement, We could see that it was in over 600 cities. I believe it was over 600 cities throughout the nation, wasn't it?
Right.
That were very actively
right.
involved in that. Right. You know, a couple of things that you have mentioned in, you know, things I've
Another
seen over
thing
the
I
Internet.
Discovered is just because the city didn't have a camp didn't mean that they weren't very active. For example, the comrades in St. Petersburg, Florida, about 20 minutes from here, they were extremely active, but they never had a camp. You know what I mean? So
right.
during the RNC, I helped organize, I shared the Republican National Convention protest in Tampa.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Most of the comrades came in that were from the area from St. Pete, from St. Petersburg, because they've always been very active, but they never had a camp, you know. So a lot of people assumed that most of the comrades were from Tampa, but no, the local comrades, a lot of them came from St. Pete, and I have a lot of respect for the people over there, you know.
Right. Well, I know what I saw taking place at that time in the country, it was a real inspiration to myself, and I think it was a real inspiration to the left. much of that carried over into the elections that took place in 2012. We saw many of the leaders on the left and many of the people that were running for public office, including myself. We were there. I was right there in New York, and you know the demonstrations right there in front of Wall Street and up in that area.
We know that told the Dems, all right? The Dems that came down for the RNC protests. I told them straight up. I said, I think Obama's more dangerous than Romney. And they asked me to elaborate on that. and Sherry agreed with me. I mean, Sherry Honkala, the vice presidential candidate of the Greens, she agreed with me.
Explain that.
What would happen if Romney was elected, Stuart? What would be happening today, comrade? You know what would be happening today. Exactly what happened in Spain. When the right-wing candidate, Rajoy, was elected into power in Spain, it revived the Indignados movement. The Indignados movement started with Zapatero, a bourgeois socialist from Spain, much like Hollande today in France, who's an imperialist. So Zapatero was in power. The economic decline started in Spain. And they had their Indignados, the Indignant Ones, movement start. They were starting to die down towards the end of Zapatero's government. And then what helped revive them? When the right-winger Rajoy was elected, there would be a million people on the streets in D.C. protesting. You know, these little Dems, they would be, you know, organizing these protests in D.C. today if Romney threatened to go to war with Syria like Obama did. But because it's Obama, then they don't want to go out to the streets. So I'm not saying vote for Romney. I'd much rather vote for a third party, but I'm just saying that that's what would happen. That's the hypocrisy in the nation right now that needs to be combated.
Right. And a lot of what we've seen over the years is that they have used the Democrats to co-opt the left. In other words, people say, well, we have a leader now on the left, and we know Obama's the furthest thing away from being leadership for the left. I'm going to take this suggestion a little different direction. I just want to mention very briefly we have today joining the Socialist Insight is Al Suarez. He is a resident there in the state of Florida. We're talking a little bit about, we're talking more in depth about his book, Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. And he just recently published that book. Al, where can people find your book to be able to obtain that, copies of it?
Sure. This past summer, I published the book. It can be found on Kindle, CreateSpace, or Amazon. Or if you're in the Tampa Bay area, you can go to my next book show, which is December 9th at 7 p.m. at Inkwood Books in downtown Tampa. So that'll be my second book show here locally. Hope you can make
Good.
It. And my pen name is Al R. Suarez, so just make sure to put middle initial R if you can't find me on there, S-U-A-R-E-Z. You can find me on Facebook as well. I'm on Stewart's page.
Good. I appreciate Al putting that information out there so people can be able to obtain copies of the book. Al, I'm just going to take this in a little different direction from where we've been going because obviously you have had many – leaders on the left to inspire you, but one in particular, you mentioned that you have said that Noam Chomsky has inspired you. Please just share with our listeners, how has Chomsky been an inspiration in your life and also your writings?
Well, yeah, he's a hero that's alive today, because to be honest, most of my heroes are dead. And I had the honor to meet him in Boston. And, you know, I don't agree with everything he says, obviously, but I, you know, have read a couple of his books, and I've listened to many of his speeches and lectures, and, you know, he's a very inspirational figure, and I think he was a moral force in the Occupy movement. Unfortunately, when he came to the camp at Boston, I wasn't there yet. I was in Vermont, but I did go to his office at MIT after that and got to meet up with him, and I've maintained a correspondence with him and have a picture with him that's in my book as well. So, yeah, he was a moral force there, and he can be described as many different things, ideologically, anarcho-syndicalist, libertarian socialist, a lot of these terms that are foreign or old to the average American, because when they hear the word libertarian, they assume they're right-wingers, like they are in this country, and syndicalism, they have no idea what it is. They don't know the history of the Spanish Civil War. I just really found it was shocking. A lot of these occupiers they didn't know the basic history of socialism and all these other things that, that came to pass, you know, the Russian Revolution, Trotsky, Lenin. They don't have any idea or ever read the literature on these guys. You know, these new wave anarchists came, and they were against organization. They had no, you know, knowledge of history. And, you know, they came, and they really, you know, defamed a lot of people and helped split up the movement. And I'm sure a lot of them were provocateurs. I'm sure a lot of them were infiltrators. They had to have been.
Yeah.
And that's all mentioned in my book.
Now, one of the things that you have mentioned that I would like for you to explain to our listeners, I would like for you to explain what a new wave anarchist is in the Occupy sense. First, explain what an anarchist is, and then you say a new wave in the Occupy sense. Explain that.
Sure. Well, first, Chomsky talked about this on my Blog Talk radio show that I used to have. You know, he said that the Black Bloc and their tactics within Occupy of violence is wrong because they are using a nonviolent movement. If they autonomously want to go and break a window, they're more than welcome to do that. But don't use the name Occupy and make us look bad and make sure to do it in front of cameras. So, you know, to be an anarchist is to have those in authority, in positions of authority, justify their authority. Okay? So real anarchists, in the Chomsky sense, they're not against all types of authority. They're just those that are in a position of authority that want to abuse their power. They have to justify that or they should go. You know what I mean? He gives the example of him as a grandfather. He stopped his grandfather, his granddaughter from running in front of a car. He grabbed her by her arm. That was exerting authority. Was that justified? So that's what a real type of anarchist is. But these new waves, they come in, and they're against organization altogether. If you're not of their ideology, they're extremely dogmatic. You know what I mean? So this, if you're not of their ideology, you have to be hierarchy. And the worst possible thing you can be to these types of anarchists is hierarchy.
Right.
You know, they'll spray paint the pyramid on your tent and try to throw you out because you're hierarchy. You're not part of them.
Right.
And unfortunately, in the Civil War, I witnessed, in particular in New Haven, you know, they went after a lot of people. A lot of people happen to be colored, happen to be poor, happen to be homeless. And these kids could always go back to mommy and daddy, mostly middle-class white kids. And they put on their masks, and they cause all these problems, and they attack fellow occupiers. And I exposed them. I had enough. And it's all mentioned in my book. And it's not to try to make Occupy look bad, but for us to learn a lesson. So we make future movements, we have to understand the importance of leadership and organization, because if we don't, it's going to all fall apart, just like what happened with Occupy. We're in solidarity, right?
Well,
I'm only in solidarity
with
my comrades, my real comrades, but they were ultimately helped destroy the movement.
Well, Al, when you say leadership and you say anarchists, you know, and many people that were in the Occupy movement and part of the Occupy movement, they detested leadership. So when you say Occupy,
at the same time they said that we're all leaders. Okay, so that was kind of a contradiction right there. That they said that we're all leaders and nobody's a leader.
Right? How can everyone be a leader?
How could exist without Martin Luther King? Right? There had to have been some type of leadership there in that movement.
Right, because look at the success that Martin Luther King had. I mean, you know, people identified a leader, and usually you saw this leader being the voice. But many people I see on the left, when you, especially anarchists, you know, which, you know, we need them to be part of this revolutionary movement. But when you talk about leadership, we don't need any leadership. How can you accomplish that?
Well,
how can you accomplish your goals without leadership?
If you want to talk about reform, comrade, look at Obamacare. Look at that disaster, right? No public option whatsoever. I mean, it's just a complete disaster. It's a capitulation to the insurance companies. Now they're forcing people to get into insurance companies, you know?
Right.
So if they should look at the European model, not the Canadian model.
And that's failed leadership.
Absolutely.
Right.
So that's the antithesis of leadership. You're not taking on those same insurance companies, you know?
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Should Occupy, should they have had leaders in that movement?
Absolutely. I think that if we had elected leaders within the movement from the General Assembly process, that we would have been able to prevent infiltration. And the Orwellian term, well, we're going to be infiltrated if we have leaders, was actually the opposite. We were so easily infiltrated because of the lack of leadership.
I see. Well, that's going to take us to my next question. What causes division within the movement? It sounds like you're saying because there was a lack of leadership.
Yeah, Lenin always talked about discipline, the Bolsheviks. I mean, that's a great example right there. You know, we had no discipline. We had people using drugs on camp. You know, we had all these things going down. We had all this hypocrisy. You know, like if you're outside of my clique and you're using drugs, you're kicked out. But if you're with me, you can use drugs. It's like, you know, just, you know, high school crap. This wasn't a serious organized discipline movement. It wasn't. It was infantile. It was a new movement. So, I gave it a lot of shots. I said, okay, well, they can do better. Let's try to work this out, you know. But it just got too much. And that's why future movements need to learn from the mistakes that we made all together, that we all made in taking part in this movement. And there was a lot of great things that we did. Don't get me wrong. Civil disobedience is always a great act, I think. But was it effective? It's a question of tactics, you know.
Well, was it?
I think it helped change the discourse within the nation.
Well, that's true.
Certainly when you hear Obama and his speech mention the 1%, you know, it's laughable. But, you know, in general in the public, those that are informed about occupying, their discourse, that matters. That can help raise the consciousness more. People are changing the way they talk. And that's part of a worldwide movement as well.
Right. Well, one of the things I know what took place with Occupy, it made the right take notice. Because all of a sudden you saw the press was on alert, you saw the administration was on alert, all the authorities were on alert. I mean, Occupy really was a serious threat to the right. And what was good about Occupy, it brought the left alive. I mean, they came alive. But the problem was the movement was
left in the beginning, but a lot of Tea Partiers left their group and came over to us. Some of them pretended to leave Tea Party, and they still were part of Tea Party, so they were infiltrators. Others, you know, were very concerned about civil liberties and wanted to join up with us. And I think you can have some type of limited united front there, but you have to have the same principles and the same aims, you know, for there to be less opposition in this country.
Well, you know, you talk about the Tea Party, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, they're very extreme right. But let me ask you this, Al. What is the difference between...
Well, they're trying to compare Occupy to them. I didn't like that.
Obviously, you know I'm a socialist.
Yeah.
What is the major differences between the new wave anarchists and socialists? Because you understand both sides, to our listeners, in your opinion.
Well, I have a lot of comrades in it. Describe themselves as anarcho-socialists. But they have nothing to do with anarchists. As a matter of fact, they dislike the new wave anarchists even more than pure socialists because they're using their ideology and they're doing things that, in many cases, the exact opposite of what they're supposed to be about. Because in Spain, the anarchists during the Civil War had their own political parties, had their own leadership. These new wave anarchists never even heard of the Spanish Civil War, if they can find Spain on a map. So, you know, you have these kids, these teenagers that, you know, they say they're anarchists, they want to be rebellious, hate all authority, but they don't know any of the basic history of what anarchism was really about and how they were going to be socialists in Spain and all these other countries.
Al, moving on to, again, looking at how the Occupy movement could have been better organized, in your opinion, again, what could have been done to make the Occupy organization, well, I shouldn't even say organization because it wasn't really an organization, but what could have made it more of an organized movement? Because somewhere in there, there was a great feeling. It was a movement that the nation was ready for, that the left was ready for, but it was very disorganized. What could have been done to make it more organized?
Well, what I mentioned earlier, elections within the movement, I mean, that's what the Bolsheviks did. Within their party, they had elections for leadership. So, you know, in the General Assembly, we had a thing called the GA, the General Assembly, to make proposals and all types of decisions, kind of like Robert's Rules, like you do in Parliament or Congress. We had something similar to that within our own movement. It was supposed to be more egalitarian, more horizontal democracy, direct democracy, if you will. And they had direct actions, autonomous actions that contradicted that because they're outside the GA process, built barricades on camp, things like that, when they were going to have a raid go down. Because it was almost impossible to get anything done in a GA process that was set up. They had facilitators, but they were self-appointed, the facilitators in the GA process. So if they actually had leaders that were elected by the majority of the members to represent us, then I think that we could have had more order within the GA process. And use the word organization, order, leadership. These are all taboo words to these new wave anarchists because they're completely irrational.
Right.
But unfortunately, they were able to have the block process because, you know, I always say nobody's as undemocratic as a new wave anarchist because I'm not trying to bash them, but they love the block process when it's convenient to them. That means 5% say their block is, what was the term? I don't remember the term right now, but if the block was, as I mentioned in my book, but if the block basically was appropriate and 5% thought your block was appropriate, it didn't matter if 90% were in favor of the proposal would be shut down. So that was basically a dictatorial power right there that the New Wave anarchists loved to use whenever they showed up to GA to block things because they didn't get their way. And that disillusioned a lot of people, have a lot of people leave the movement as a result. And a lot of people that left the movement were diehards, people arrested the movement, they gave it their all. So I'm not trying to bash people that left the movement or were forced out of the movement. A lot of the good people were forced out of the movement or were in situations like that.
Let me ask you this, because here on the left, we really believe in democratic principles, democracy. Why didn't we see more democratic principles in the Occupy movement? Because it seemed like that would have been the first thing. How are we going to organize our leaderships and use a democratic process? Why wasn't that done?
Because people are too busy worried about internal drama. You know, it's like the whole level threes thing, which I think was a legitimate concern, but they put too much attention on. You know, like the cops, you know, love to send in level three sex offenders and criminals and take them out of jail and throw them to our camps. That's a fact. That's substantiated evidence on that. But whenever they did that, at the same time, they would come and bring the papers and show the names whenever it was convenient for them so that they come and bring the proposal on behalf of the cops and divide up our movement. They did it in Boston, they did it in New Haven, they did it in a lot of different occupies, and it wasn't coincidental. They're trained by the same people, the same tactics as the government.
Right.
They're coming in, and they're causing these divisions.
Right.
And it can go on for, you know, 10 GAs over the course of 2 months of deciding whether or not level threes can be banned, and then a block comes, and the level threes are more than welcome to our meetings again, with children present, for God's sake. So, very emotional issues. I actually am agreeing with that there are certain groups of people that should be banned. There are danger to a movement. But there was too much attention on it. It was used to divide us up. The Women's Caucus, half of them walked out of the GA. You know, I was in solidarity with them. But, you know, it just caused so much division afterwards. You saw innocent people that had no criminal record for doing something like that. They were forced out of the movement. And it was really sad, you know.
Once again, I'm just going to mention Al Suarez. He's joining our program today. Al is talking a little bit about his book, which is a very interesting subject, and the name of our topic today, Solidarity Forever? The Struggle of an Occupier. And we know that Al Suarez, he was an occupier throughout the East Coast. He's a revolutionary. And Al, could you just share with our listeners once again how they can obtain copies of your new book?
Sure. If you just got on, you just got to Google it or go on Amazon and search for it under that title. So Solidarity Forever? Struggle of an Occupier by Al R. Suarez. So it's either on Amazon, Kindle, or CreateSpace.
And that's Al R. Suarez. That would be the appropriate way to look it up, correct?
Yeah, middle initial R, yep.
And thanks again for joining the program. Al, I'm going to just talk a little bit more about Occupy, and then we're going to get into a couple other things. Has, in your opinion again, has the Occupy movement run its course?
Well, I think that if you look at the faces of those who remain in the movement, especially in Tampa, they're all white. And if you look at their backgrounds, because, you know, I'm also an investigative journalist, you see that they have large sums of money in their bank accounts. So I think the few people that still show up to GA are either paid to go there or they're representing their clique. And they successfully kicked out all the colors, all the homeless, all these people out of the movement that were mostly innocent. That were scapegoats within the movement because, again, there was a lack of leadership. There was nobody there to protect them, and they were vulnerable, and they kicked them out of the camps. And I thought it was an injustice. And they had petitions by local people, especially colored people, to kick them out. I actually, ironically, you know, because I went to court for camps, I was arrested defending camps, I actually felt some sympathy with those people that were taking them to the council and trying to force them out because, you know, they kicked out so many black people and were so disrespectful that they had enough, you know, and there was no leadership. I'm saying most people in the movement that left the movement by then, they were decent people, but they didn't want to come back and be leaders and say, look, guys, this is wrong. Stop kicking these people out. Stop doing this. Let's respect the community's wishes and move elsewhere. It didn't happen. So, you know, I'm not saying that I don't want to take part in activism anymore. I'm still very much an activist. It's just, You have to adapt right. your tactics, and you have to learn your lessons from mistakes you've made.
Well, how were you personally affected by the Occupy movement in hindsight?
Well, it was a very traumatic experience for me. I was homeless at the time. I was going through a tragedy in my life. And, you know, some things were blocked out of my mind, but everything that I recollected, and this whole thing with the comrades that I still in touch with that were part of the movement, I put as much as I could in the book so people can really see what went down from the inside. And it's not like an intellectual talking about it. It's somebody who was in there, who's telling from the firsthand experience what went down, you know. So it's something that should be discussed.
Well, again, in hindsight, and maybe we'll see the Occupy movement coming back to life, but what tactics need to be adapted?
What tactics need to be what?
Adapted. I mean, what? In other words, if we're to move forward with anything that's left of Occupy, what do we need to adapt where we can be able to, this movement, where it can still be able to pick up momentum as a viable tool for the left?
The few things that Occupy is still doing is stuff like Occupy Sandy, which I think is great. They're actually doing social services for the community. A lot of people weren't occupiers before, but I think it's ironic as well, because in the beginning, the homeless issue, acting as social servants, was a huge issue in the Occupy that we were a part of. And then it was, we're not social workers anymore. This isn't for us, and, you know, they have to go. But now that they're doing these social services, Occupy Sandy, stuff like that, that's a great tactic to give back to the community, you know, community organizing, things like that. You know, but occupied
right.
public spaces, this was a temporary, you know, measure. And there was, you know, limited success on that. So that's something we have to move on from and go on to use
right.
different tactics, you know. And nonviolence to civilians is essential. Information to the public, you know. Most of the public knows things are screwed up, but what are they going to do about it? If you feel for complacent or anything about it, that's why you need actives and help inspire them to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, they had hundreds of activists arrested during civil disobedience. That is an inspiring act.
Right.
I would have loved to have been there for that moment. But there was a lot of moments like that, you know, that inspire the public and get them more aware of these issues.
Al, I'm going to look back to the 50s and the 60s and what I saw there in the streets in Alabama and Mississippi and even here in California where, you know, we saw the activism on the left and especially in the black communities. And we saw that during the time of Martin Luther King where they eventually had to go out in the streets and they had to be arrested. And there was violence and there were police dogs and there were police and there was blood. But we saw this in the streets of America. And we saw, you know, citizens on both sides. We saw whites and we saw blacks. But in the civil rights movement, it was anything but peaceful. It was a very violent movement. But when we're talking about revolution, when we're talking about revolution today, is nonviolent revolution possible?
Depends on the conditions of the country. Look at Egypt, perfect example. Mubarak.
Well, look at the condition of this country. I mean,
well, I'm just giving an example.
Look at working
this country. Nonviolence is, I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's very hard if you compare it to what happened in Egypt, you know. Because in Egypt,
right.
Mubarak had a lot of support from the United States up until the very end. But so many people rose up, and the military backed up in support of him, he was forced to step down. That was nonviolent. There was a little
right.
bit of violence instituted, like in the communities when he released the prisoners to mug people and stuff. They had, you know, knives. They didn't have guns like they have here. So they had limited violence they used to defend their communities. But it was predominantly on the protesters side, nonviolence, and they were successful. So people don't have to necessarily talk about, oh, we backed Gandhi. This is recent history, 2010, that Egypt was able to be successful in that, and that helped inspire us over here.
Well, I mean, right now when we look at the other side, what I was mentioning about the police dogs and the police and the violence that was taking place on both sides, we still see violence taking place against the left in this country. I mean, they have come out with all kinds of laws and going into parks and you can be arrested. And many of the people that participated in Occupy, now these same people are standing before municipalities and magistrates and judges where they're being, you know, prosecuted. I mean, Al, we see that they have a whole range of laws, and the whole Department of Homeland Security, and the federal government is working with local authorities how they can suppress any movement like this in the future.
Especially student
movement.
Look at the
federal ground.
And I'm organizing for my college.
I mean, we talk about the federal
UNI
grounds
students
to
were arrested
that.
For protesting the presence of a war criminal, General Petraeus, on their campus. He's not going to be arrested.
Yeah, so the violence
well,
was already
there. But they received him violently and threw them in jail. So that just
right.
goes to show that there's still violence right now, even though there's not a huge movement going down. There's still cases
right.
like that.
The violence is there. So,
because
I mean,
how do we know this? Listen, there's a cop. I forget his last name. I think it's Lewis. Ray Lewis. That's it. The captain from Philadelphia went to New York and got arrested with the occupiers in uniform. So that police captain helped reveal statistically that a cop, in order to become a cop in America, has to show they're insensitive. And why do they do that?
Right.
Because they see so much blood, they don't want to waste money on training them, so they could quit. But they actually lose money because of all the lawsuits from them being so insensitive and beating the crap out of people. And number two, the IQ test. They have to have a low IQ. That's in court. That's a fact. They had a cop who,
right.
A guy who wanted to be a cop who had high IQ. And the judge sided with the police and said, you're going to be too bored. Your IQ is too high to be a cop. So number one, you got to be a brute. Number two, you got to be insensitive. And you have this
right.
tradition where, you know, a lot of white cops. So that's why we have so much brutality against color people. And, you know, the cops, and I'm not saying it's just happening in America, but their role a lot of times is to suppress the people. Are they workers like us? Do they have pensions? Yes. But they're also bought off by Wall Street with the Bloomberg and his so-called private army. Don't think he's leaving. But, you know, they just had impunity and all these things went down against their own class.
I want to ask you, Al, we know that Hugo Chavez, he was a strong leader representing, you know, left politics there in Venezuela. But, and obviously he's one of the great leaders in the 20th and the 21st century. But do you think the politics and the leadership style of socialism of Hugo Chavez is a form of socialism that is possible today?
Absolutely. It's happening throughout South America. Why can't it happen here? He's left a legacy there, you know. I mean, my father's Peruvian. I know South America. And I'm in touch with many
been there, right?
in Venezuela and throughout the world. I've been to Peru. I lived in Peru a couple of years. I know these people. I lived in Spain, you know, where the imperialists used to come from. And there's a big, strong movement of the left in Spain as well. And throughout Latin America, Venezuela, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, all these countries are uniting now. And since the time of Bolivar, you know, the liberator, you haven't seen such unity. And then Bolivar, when he died, he left behind divided Latin America. And his disciple Chavez maintained his legacy to unite the continent. Like when they got rid of the Spanish imperialists, they knew the American imperialists were going to come.
Mm-hmm.
So now American empire is losing its influence in the Southern Hemisphere, and it's very inspiring. And Europeans, when they downed Evo Morales' plane thinking Snowden was on board, they were on their knees begging for mercy to South Americans, begging to do business with them again. Because while they're starving in Europe, eating out the trash in Greece and Spain and all these countries, Latin America is progressing. So now the former imperialists from Europe are begging to do business with South America, which I find ironic. And I think America's losing its influence, not just in the Southern Hemisphere, but in Europe as well. The empire is falling. And here at home, we need to do something about it.
Al, we have just under 15 minutes, and we're going to try to cover quite a bit within the next few minutes here. So I'm going to hit some things like some bullets, but I still want you to cover a few more items here. But, you know, we have third parties, and we have the big two parties, which basically they're one party with two names. But how can third parties unite and make a strong party that can combat those two parties, as I mentioned, one party with two names? How can third parties unite?
Well, we've talked about this, comrade. I mean, if you read a speech by a Green Party person and a Socialist Party person, and you don't say who read the speech, you can't tell the difference between the two. I'm not saying you're identical, but on the fundamentals, there's so much in common, there needs to be a united front. There could not be an effective left opposition in this country without unity among the third parties.
Well, help me out here, Al, okay? Just help me out, just for a minute. I was running as a socialist candidate, and I was also seeking the Green Party's nomination there in 2012. And the Greens, they heard what I was saying, and they wanted me to completely disenfranchise myself from the Socialist Party, the Socialist Movement, and basically just to go completely under the banner of the Green Party. And I was seeking the nomination for both parties. And mostly I came under attack from the Green leadership. So basically, if you're looking at it from that perspective, and socialists are willing to create some, well, the socialists and I'm referring with the Socialist Party USA, which I've been a member of that party for some time, and also the Peace and Freedom Party for 15 years.
Right.
But where do you start when you have, you know, parties such as the Green Party? And I'm not, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to bash the Greens, but,
right,
you know, the ones that think that capitalism can be reformed as opposed to socialism, we believe that capitalism needs to be completely abolished. And that's basically where the Greens come from. They believe that capitalism can be reformed. What is your opinion on that, about the Greens'
I can tell you this.
That ideology?
I can tell you this. I'm an independent. Okay, ideologically, I'm a socialist.
Sure.
But, you know, I'm not with any particular party. I like people that are in socialist party, like people in the Green Party, both. And, you know, there are differences. I didn't say you're identical, right? There are differences.
Right.
But it's
right,
not a question of, you know, asking for an endorsement anymore. It's doing what the IWW did in their time, uniting all the unions. As I'm saying, you make a brand new party. Make it big. Take people from the Greens. Take people from the socialists and make their own party, but a big party that can have a shot at going after the other two parties. And,
how do you do that when you
let me finish. I just came back from Philly with a lot of Green Party members there, including their leadership. Yeah, David Cobb there, Sherry Honkola, Dr. Joel Stein. They were all
right
there. And I gave a speech there. I was part of the Florida delegation. And in my speech, I said that capitalism is a disease. It needs to be cured, that Joel Stein should understand this. I also said in my speech that we have to go beyond reform, that revolution was the only way. I said it very clear, and it was well received by all of them. They came up to me and said they liked the speech. None of them said, no, we actually think capitalism can be fixed. None of them dare tell me that. Now, are there people like that that think like that within the Green Party? Absolutely. Okay, but like I said, there is still a substantial amount of people that believe in revolution, not reform, that know their history, that know what needs to be done, and that could help form a brand new party, taking people that were part of Socialists, part of Greens, and making a brand new revolutionary party that would be above that.
Well, basically, what is keeping the two parties divided right now? I mean, keeping the left divided right now?
I mean, I think there are still Dems that are convinced that they can hang on to this dream that, you know, Obama's going to be the new JFK and this and that. It's like they live in their little dream world, you know? And I don't even want to try to convince them anymore. What did Lenin say about them? I mean, they didn't exist like they do today then, but there were similar people. He called them the social democrats, the liberals, you know, I don't want to be too offensive here, but useful idiots, you know, that some of them were useful idiots.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to patiently explain to the masses things. But at the same time, Lenin knew when they explained and had to stop. And the action had to start, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Comrade
right.
Lenin knew that these people, that they had their use, but there was a time when the radicals and the revolutionaries, you needed to unite and you needed to back an action and do something about it, you know. So those, you know, so-called progressives that still want to hang on to their, you know, dream of a new JFK, they need to move on, and they need to come and they need to join a brand new party and help organize that party. And if they're going to be transparent about their views, if they're going to have the same principles as ours and be on the same platform, then we can go ahead and do that.
I'm going to get into a little more into politics, recent politics is taking place with the election of Kashama Sawant there in the state of Washington. She was elected to the city council there in for Seattle. And after Sawant, once she was elected, I might mention that she's from, I believe, from India. Once she was elected, we had a buzz going across the nation, the internet, about socialists running for public office for various state positions. People were even putting out there about Bernie Sanders, and Bernie Sanders was saying that, you know, if no one runs to represent the left or a viable candidate, he's ready to run. I just want you to share in your opinion about the impact of Councilwoman-elect Sawant making that very important position as a socialist running her campaign.
Well, before I get into Kashama Sawant, let me just ask you, are you familiar with Mayor Kiss?
No, I'm not.
Okay, he was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont when he shut our camp down during Occupy. He's mentioned in my book. And he is a so-called socialist. He's not independent, I don't remember the name of his third party, but he's considered a socialist within that state. and betrayed us. He lured us into City Hall when one of our campers shot himself, and you know, they brought out the tear gas, which is illegal in Massachusetts. It's technically chemical warfare. So they brought out the tear gas, and you know, they lured us in, and they deceived us, and they shut down our camp, destroyed our TP in the most
unthinkable
way.
And you say he's a socialist, right?
Mayor Kitsch, you can look him up. He's a third party guy. He's not a Democrat.
Okay.
And he went along with
third party or third party or socialist.
So as long as it's not the party, you would say it's a small political party for Vermont, but it is known as Progressive and Socialist. It's not part of Bernie Sanders' party, I don't think, but it's a small party, and he was able to get elected. So he was an exception to the rule, like what happened in Washington State. Because Sharma, everything she said, everything she represented until now, I'm very happy about it. Okay, I'm not comparing her to Mayor Kiss. I'm just giving an example that when you're in a position as limited a mayor or a city councilman, how much difference can you make? I'm not downplaying what she's done and the symbolism behind this, especially since she's a colored woman. She's Indian descent from India. But, you know, Mayor Kiss is just another example of, you know, even when you have somebody who's so-called progressive and not a Democrat who becomes a mayor. I mean, it happened in New York recently. He is a Democrat, but they say he's very progressive, that he was an Occupy supporter. He might have just been another opportunity. I don't know. But he's certainly better than Bloomberg. Anybody better than Bloomberg. But the thing is, the whole lesser of two evils mentality. That's another thing. You know, as long as you're behind the lesser of two evils mentality, you're going to let evil continue to happen, right?
Right.
So, you know, Kashava, let me get back to Kashama now. I'm very inspired by the fact that you had a woman of Indian descent be able to be a councilwoman in Seattle, Washington, which is a very progressive city. I'm very proud of her and very happy about it. But how much difference can she make until we structurally, as revolutionaries, change the so-called two-party system, right? There has to be a transformation.
Right.
That's part of revolution.
Exactly. Well, talking just a little bit more about Bernie Sanders and talking about leadership for 2014 and 2016, is there any leadership that you can see, viable leadership for the left here in the U.S.? For national, state or national offices?
Yeah, the people are there. The question is organizing and getting the masses behind them.
Right. I'm going to just, we have another less than 5 minutes, and I just want to mention once again, we have Al Suarez. He recently wrote a book that we are discussing, well, we have discussed, I should say, on the program today, and looking at my notes here, it's the name of the book is Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier. So, Al, I just very briefly, and we're going to do one more mention of your book before the end of the show, but just can you mention how our listeners can be able to obtain copies of your new book that was just released?
Yeah, I believe you can purchase it for $15. You can Facebook me about this if you're not sure how to find it, but you can certainly find it on Amazon. Solidarity Forever The Struggle of an Occupier. Al R. Suarez.
And how can our listeners be able to reach you? How can our listeners reach you, Al?
Yes, Al Suarez, Alsuarez, on Facebook. I'm on your page. I'm on Ruthann's page as well.
Good. Al, just in the last 3 or 4 minutes we have here, you live right there. I believe you live in Tampa, correct?
Yeah, I'm 2 hours from Sanford. I mean, about 3 hours from Jacksonville, where the Versus Alexander case is going on. You asked me about her, right?
Right, and I just wanted to speak very briefly on Marissa Alexander because, you know, that is definitely a wrong that I think took place. We have a lot of buzz and feed through the Internet of people that have objected to what happened to this woman. But could you just share a little bit about that case and about staying your ground there in the state of Florida?
You can go on Hawkeye.net and see my article recently published about Marissa Alexander under Alex Suarez if you want to know more from my college paper. But, yeah, she's been in the media lately. And a lot of people, when they talk about her, they don't mention that it's the same prosecutor who let Zimmerman go, pretty much. She railroaded this poor lady. So here's a mother, estranged from her husband, who was beating her and had a restraining order against him. He barged into the house, was strangling her. She was able to get away, and then when she went into her garage, the garage door was jammed. So subsequently, she grabbed a gun that she was registered to her, and shot in the air out of desperation for him to stop. And she got a mandatory sentence of 20 years in jail. She tried to defend herself
on the ground,
which only applies to whites in this state. And they didn't give her a right to self-defense. She was not injured, but she got 20 years, and now finally she's doing a retrial. She just was recently bailed out, thank God. But now they're doing a retrial. They have petitions, public pressure. But it's just outrageous, especially considering Angela Corey, the same prosecutor who let Zimmerman go for killing Trayvon, was the one that was railroading Marissa in Jacksonville, Florida.
Al, when I lived there, and I saw much of the poverty in the black communities, and I saw on a regular basis blacks being hauled off to jail, sitting there in the back of police units, there was a great disparity between what you could see happening with blacks as opposed to what was happening with whites. But, Al, there seemed like we have the old Jim Crow laws there that are in full force there in Florida. What's going on in Florida? Talk to me.
Well, they were persecuting Mexicans in neighboring Georgia a couple years ago, and I was protesting that, and I knew that they were going to come up with a stand your ground type law to go after the blacks as well. And the ALEC corporations and, you know, the ALEC lobby and the corporations, they supported these racist laws, stand your ground, spreading to Florida and all these other states in the South, which is kind of like, as you said, a reemergence of Jim Crow. And it only applies to whites. That means if I feel threatened by you and I see you on the street, I can shoot you in your head. And if I'm a white man, especially if you're a colored guy, I'll get away with it. So if I wound you and you can testify against me in court, it's the radical interpretation of the law, but that's what's enforced right now. So if I wound you or I shoot in the air, I can get, you know, 10, 20 years. But if I kill you, if I silence you and there's no witnesses, then I can get away with murder. It's a cowboy law, and that's what's in law in Florida right now. It's insane. And you have people in Tallahassee in the state house protesting it, but the law is still in force.
Well,
and in contrast to what happened with Marissa, it makes it so fundamentally racist that something needs to be done about it. It's here in my backyard, and I want to do something about it, but I'm very disappointed in the lack of activism on this. And that's why, as a journalist as well, I'm trying to write and expose and let the students know what went down with Marissa, because an amazing number of them haven't even heard of her.
Exactly, and I see the same thing, which I am surprised of. We're going to have more discussion on the case of Marissa Alexander. She's supposed to be going to trial, her second trial, next year, I believe, in the early part of
in
the
March.
Year. But we will be talking about that
in
March.
We'll
be talking about that again. Al, once again, I just want you to mention about your book. We have 1 minute. Mention about your book and how people can obtain that, and then we're going to wrap this up.
Yeah, I'm on Kindle. I'm on createspace.com, and I'm on amazon.com. So look me up, Solidarity Forever, The Struggle of an Occupier, or look me up on Facebook, Al Suarez, S-U-A-R-E-Z, or if you're in Tampa, December 19th, 7 p.m., come to Inkwood Books and come to my second book show, ask me anything you want, and I'll be happy to sign a book for you.
Al, I appreciate you joining the program, and we'll be looking forward to having you to join the Socialist Insight at a future date. Will you come on again?
Yeah, we like our callers, too. It would be very insightful.
Okay. Thank you very much. And once again, I'd like to thank our listeners for joining the Socialist Insight, and we'll see you next week when Alan Mackey, he'll be joining the program. Again, thanks again, Al. Thank you, Ruth Ann. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Pleasure. Good night.